Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics like mercury, PFAS, pesticides are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Maya Ramwat. She is senior marketing campaigner for Defend Our Health, where she's been the project manager on a research report that's just come out called Hidden Hazards, the Chemical Footprint of a Plastic Bottle, how the beverage industry's addiction to plastic bottles may prolong the climate crisis, threaten human health, and promote environmental racism. Maya, I'm excited to hear more about your hot off the press research today. Thank you so much for being here on What Mama Wants.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
I hear people talking a lot about plastic at the end of its life after its single use is done, mostly around the concepts of recycling. But your organization's looking at the whole life cycle of a plastic bottle and its role in climate pollution. Can you just frame what this whole paper is about?
Sure. Yeah, it's a lot to take in. As you said, we're trying to take in the entire life cycle of what seems like a small thing, the plastic bottle. But it turns out it's actually quite complicated, and it moves through a lot of different places before it becomes the plastic bottle as we know it. We're talking about PET plastic. That stands for polyethylene terephthalate. But the rest of us just know it as that bottle that has our soda, our water, our juice, maybe our energy drink in it. If you're not sure, it's most likely PET, but you could turn the bottle over and look at the bottom. If it says number one inside the chasing arrows, that's a PET bottle. So what we're looking at, because we know these bottles are made from fossil fuels and they're made with a very complicated process that involves a lot of steps that can be quite hazardous. We wanted to look at the whole life cycle impact, and we wanted to see how it threatens human health, how it's exacerbating climate crisis, and how it's adding to environmental injustice. And what we did was something that hasn't really been done before. We basically mapped the supply chain for a commonly heard of brand. You might have heard of it, Coca-Cola. And we used Coke
yes,
as a...
I have.
Yeah, we used Coke as a case study. But what Coke does is not any different than what the other big brands are doing. And a lot of them are buying bottles actually directly from the big brands like Coke and Pepsi. But we use them as a case study, and we map the process to the best of our abilities. Now, we didn't catalog every single bottle. There are quite a few that they use, but we did map as much as we could in North America and mostly in the US. And what we found is that the demand for these bottles that these beverage companies create by buying them, and again, these bottles are all made from fossil fuels, that demand is polluting our air and our water with cancer-causing chemicals, and it's polluting our climate with climate pollution. And we even found that the making of these PET bottles in the US is a top polluter. When you look at all industries, it's a top polluter for three cancer-causing chemicals. It's number one for pollution of a chemical called ethylene oxide in our air. It's number one for 1,4-dioxane in our water. And it's a huge polluter of antimony in our food and beverages. And then, like we see over and over again with industry, the pollution that's coming out of this industry isn't even. There's a disproportionate impact. And who's feeling it and dealing with the pollution? We found that, again, like a lot of industry, the folks who are most impacted, who are most likely to live in the areas where these manufacturing plants are situated and sited, are more often Black and brown, and more often low-income communities. And then to add to all that, it's driving climate crisis even worse. So we looked at the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of these plants, and it's equivalent to 2 million extra cars on the road for a year just to make all these bottles. It's a lot of bottles.
Wow.
So not only are they made from oil and gas, and that's an issue, but it takes a great deal of oil and gas to make the bottles.
And then you're stuck with all the bottles because they don't ever go away.
Right.
Yeah, it surprises me that no one's done this mapping the whole footprint of the life cycle of a plastic bottle before. We talk about plastic bottles kind of a lot, but I don't think we're looking at the big picture. That's stunning.
Yeah, it's quite a lot to take in.
Why does your organization invest time and resources into a project like this?
Well, as you said, it hasn't really been done before. And part of the reason is because it's not super easy. But like the report you said is called Hidden Hazards, and we are basically trying to reveal something that we think is very important that is also fairly hidden. There's been a lot of focus on the waste end with these plastic bottles, and that's super important. But we don't want to lose sight of everything that happens before the bottles even get to the store, let alone thrown out. So we want to expose this in part because we think it's really important that the companies that are purchasing these bottles take responsibility for the impact of the bottles manufacturing. It's not very common for companies to look what we call upstream in their supply chains, all the way back to how things are made, because it's frankly quite complicated. And it involves a number of steps that the companies are not directly in charge of. However, they are creating the demand for the bottles. And by doing that, they're essentially creating the bottles. And we think that they should be responsible for that impact. The plastic industry is projected to double in the next decade. And that's petrochemical plastics made from oil and gas. And if we don't raise the alarm about the human health impacts, the climate impacts, and the environmental injustice impacts, then they're only going to get worse. So we think it's important to begin talking about this now.
Yeah, I think it's time to. And it seems to me that the media has started to connect the dots about, for instance, how does the PET plastic, how do those ingredients get to the factories? Oh, on trains that go through our communities. And I think we're starting to connect the dots a little bit, the whole life cycle of a plastic bottle and what that means to the safety of all of us.
Indeed. And the transport of petrochemicals that are feedstocks for all these plastics, not just PET, are, as we're learning, crisscrossing the nation, often in trains that seem to be derailing all the time. And what we saw in East Palestine is, an awful tragedy. And it's one that a lot of us could experience.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine because everybody's got train tracks running through their backyards, through their towns. So what's the number one thing you want people to remember about plastic bottles after all this time you've spent? I bet you have a bottom line.
Yeah, well, just know that the waste issue is just the tip of the iceberg, and that the dangerous toxic chemicals that are used to make these bottles, we don't even know what they all are yet. So it's projected to grow. So there's a fear around that, but there's also a fear of the unknown. We don't even know every single potentially dangerous chemical that are in these bottles or used to make them. And just because a company says that they're helping solve the climate crisis, or they're going net neutral or net zero, or they're climate neutral, or that their bottles are perfectly recycled and safe, doesn't mean it's true, and doesn't mean that it's safe even to consume products out of those bottles. And it certainly doesn't mean that it's safe for the communities who live around these sites of manufacturing. You asked for one thing. I will also say just an easy thing is don't leave your plastic bottles in hot cars out in the sun, and try and remember to not microwave things in plastic. It's always a good thing to keep in mind.
Thank you. That's a real basic one. Heat and plastic, they don't go.
Yeah.
You mentioned antimony, and I bet antimony is not on a lot of people's radar. But I wanted to bring it up with this next question because this issue is so colossal that it can't really be the responsibility of consumers to be aware of the cobalt and antimony in their soda as a result of the bottle production process. Is it possible to get name brand corporations like Coca-Cola to bear responsibility for reducing harm for their growing use of plastic, including the greenhouse gas emissions? I love the idea. How?
Yeah, we think it's possible. It won't be easy, but we think it's possible. Companies like Coke, they have a soft spot, and that is that they're brand sensitive. You know, they have to sell a product. It's not like the steel industry. Nobody knows the name of it and they can get away with whatever. I mean, they can certainly get away with a lot, and they can throw a lot of money around and greenwash to the point where it's hard to make heads or tails of what's safe and what's not. But that's where groups like ours come in, and we try to hold these companies to account for keeping their consumers safer than they have been, and to keep communities safer than they have been doing. And one trick that helps is to play them off each other. So they're brand sensitive, but they're also really sensitive about what's happening with the competition. So we want all these companies to clean up their products and the process that goes into their products. And so if we can move one, we think we can move them all. Because once the word gets out that there's antimony in Coke's bottles or there's antimony in Pepsi's bottles, all the brands are paying attention. So that's one of the tricks up our sleeve. It's not a secret. They know that one. Companies like these are really sensitive to what their customers and their potential customers are hearing about them. So if we get the word out that these bottles are more dangerous than they've been letting on, and the more people who are potential customers or current customers hear it, the more nervous they get. And you mentioned antimony and cobalt. We've spoken with Coke and some other companies about the testing that we did. And we didn't mention this earlier, but we had done some testing of PET bottles for antimony and cobalt and some other heavy metals last year. And we found antimony in every bottle, alarmingly high levels in a number of bottles that we tested. And antimony, it's used as a catalyst in the production of the bottles. So it's used to speed up the process. And it's a cancer-causing chemical. And the literature out there found that it can easily migrate into liquid contained within the bottles. So when we tested, we paid a lab to also test the liquids contained within, and we found antimony in those liquids, again, at levels higher than the threshold, the California State Public Health drinking water goal. So we found a lot of antimony. We also found a lot of cobalt. Cobalt is used to keep the bottles at a certain level of clarity. And there are safer alternatives that these companies can use. Now, the plastic itself is still a problem, like we spoke about earlier with the manufacturing process. But we spoke to the companies at the time just about the antimony and the cobalt. And there was some interest, but nobody yet has moved and said that they're going to get the antimony out. And we did another round of retesting recently to see if anyone was starting to make bottles without it. And unfortunately, we still found antimony and cobalt in the bottles. So we still have some work to convince them, but we do think that by putting pressure on the companies, being public about it, that we can get some movement.
It's really a paradigm shift from consumer beware to product producers be more aware.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Coke will tell you they don't make those bottles, they buy them. But what we're asking them to do is to ask their bottle manufacturers to start using safer alternatives to antimony. And we know that Coke has enough market pull that they could probably convince them. Coca-Cola Company buys and sells 125 billion of these bottles a year. It's actually about one-fifth of the global PET bottle supply. So we know if Coke asked for it, that these bottle manufacturers would probably jump.
Yeah.
And we see that there are things made without antimony, especially in other places. I say things because we didn't mention this, but polyester and PET are basically the same thing. And there is increasingly more and more polyester being made without antimony.
Oh, so some industries are moving on this while others are dragging their feet.
Right, exactly.
I love that Defend Our Health goes after big corporations to try to bring about change, but it does beg the question, where's the regulatory body in the United States to make sure that the products that are holding fluids that we're drinking aren't going to give us cancer?
Yes. Where is it? That's a good question. Yes. It's unfortunate that it takes small nonprofits to raise the alarm about these things, but that is the place where we're at currently. FDA should be doing a little bit of a better job, but there is some legislation out there. So part of what we do is we legislate at the state level at Defend Our Health in Maine, and both Maine and the state of California currently this year have introduced legislation that would not impact PET right now, but it would start to prohibit some of the most dangerous and toxic plastics out there. So in the near future, so I'm talking like styrofoam, polystyrene, what's commonly called styrofoam, and PVC. PVC is quite dangerous. That's actually a precursor to PVC was on the train that derailed in East Palestine. So that legislation in Maine and in California, if it goes through, that would actually sort of reinforce what's out there in the business world right now as a voluntary business pledge. There's a group called the U.S. Plastics Pact, and they're holding themselves to account for these same things. But we'd like to see it codified if we could. And then, you know, we talked about air emissions with ethylene oxide and water emissions with 1,4-dioxane. EPA is responsible for regulating those things. And currently, right now, actually, the EPA is proposing some new rules for ethylene oxide that would actually impact quite a few of the plants that we looked at and help bring those emissions down. We don't think it goes quite as far as it could or should. However, it is a good step in the right direction. And EPA is taking public comment on those. It's a package of rules right now, in May and into June. So that's exciting. We also think 1,4-dioxane needs to be regulated more tightly. That is an emission to the water that happens with the resin making process. So just before PET becomes a bottle, it becomes like a little plastic pellet, and that's called resin. So 1,4-dioxane is a common pollutant in that stage.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Maya Ramwat. She's talking about a research paper that was just put out by Defend Our Health that points to extreme chemical risk, most pressingly for communities of color who live along corridors in the South where these plastic factories make bottles. Maya, with your background in biology and environmental studies, you're very good at looking at how humans impact the biological world. But you also have an eye on environmental justice, seeing the unfair ways toxic plants are cited in the poorest, often predominantly Black and brown communities. Can you tell us about what it's like for people who live next to plastic plants these days?
Sure. And I'm lucky to not be situated in one of these locations, so I can't speak from experience, but I can share what I saw on the ground. Part of our report takes storytelling from some interviews that we did and weaves it into the narrative with the pretty heavy data that we found. And so we spoke with people in a number of locations, or you could think of them as stops along the supply chain. We found two tracks feeding into the bottles that we traced. One track originated in Alberta, in the area where tar sands are mined. That's crude oil. And then the other track was coming out of the Permian Basin in southeastern New Mexico and a considerable chunk of Texas. And that's where there's a great deal of fracking going on. And so both oil and gas are coming out of that region. So we have these two tracks, and we spoke with someone in Alberta. We spoke with someone in Carlsbad, New Mexico, for both those tracks. And then we spoke with people who live in locations where there is some step in the process being manufactured. For instance, it could be a precursor to the end product, or it could be the resin at the end. And I went down to Decatur, Alabama, and spoke with an activist in that area who has done a great deal of work on PFAS, because their water is actually terribly contaminated. She helped get them a very expensive reverse osmosis water filtration system that is now taking the PFAS out, which is fantastic. Anyhow, in Decatur, there are, I think, 27 facilities along the river that are manufacturing all different kinds of things. We were there looking at this one particular facility owned by a company called Indorama, and they're making a precursor step, which they then feed into their own supply chain and moves along before it becomes a bottle. And I mentioned PFAS. There's also some PFAS being made in that area and a bunch of other stuff. I don't even know what it was. And this is right next to a community. And as I said, it's along the river. You often see this. These sites are along rivers for reasons that make sense for the industry, but become a portal to pollution that can wind up in the river. And the person I spoke with, Miss Brenda Hampton, she's in the report. She lives in a community down the road from Decatur, not terribly far. And she took me to her community and we met a bunch of people. And there are so many people who are sick. So many people with all kinds of horrible ailments. A lot of cancer, a lot of kidney failure, a lot of problems with the liver, and it is a lot for people to deal with. She shared with me how many funerals she had been to in the last 2 weeks when I was there, and it was astounding. I spoke with Jean Leoncourt, who's in the report. She's an Indigenous woman who lives in Fort McKay Reservation, and they are surrounded by Alberta tar sands extraction. And that's her ancestral homelands. She spoke to me about how impacted her community is culturally from that extraction. She's told me they still hunt moose, but when they kill a moose, that they have to check its organs to make sure it looks safe. And she shared how the tailings ponds, those are ponds filled with a liquid that's not just going to be water, but filled with a number of other things used in the mining process, that those ponds are not lined and they leach into the river and everyone downstream has gotten ill. And it's pretty tragic. I spoke with a person in Carlsbad, Kaylee Shoup, young woman. She grew up there and she moved away and came back home to find the fracking boom had taken over her town. And she describes herself as not having been an environmentalist or very environmentally aware. But after she got home, she started wondering why people she knew who were young and seemed very healthy were all suddenly very sick. And she became quite active. She's actually part of a small group now who's fighting the extraction in that area and the pollution that comes out of it. So over and over again, we see, even though each of those sites is like very different types of things happening, that the impact is often very similar. And Kaylee Shoup from Carlsbad said something that I thought was pretty compelling, which was that she recognizes that all these sites, that they're all fighting the same battle. They're all David and Goliath, that these enormous corporations creating this pollution that they're just all beset by.
This reminds me so much of a movie I saw, a documentary called Man versus Ford. Have you seen that movie?
I haven't.
It's M-A-N-N. It's the last name of a Native American man in, I think it's Mahwah, New Jersey. And the pollution that was put out from the Ford company there and deliberately put on the lands of Native American people with blatant disregard. The environmental justice factor on that one is off the charts, but it reminds me so much of it. Why is this where these plastic production facilities are sited?
Well, our legacy of racism is a legacy. It's ongoing. And where we allow companies to site this stuff reflects on who we value in our communities and in our culture. And it's a terrible injustice. And that's why, you know, environmental racism is part of a bigger picture that we have not even begun to grapple with hardly in this country. But it's important that we do. And, you know, another thing about these communities is it's very hard for people to speak up. Oftentimes, people work in these
they
sites.
They rely on it for their livelihood mm-hmm. in rural places.
Mm-hmm. And so it's complicated.
Yes, it's complicated. It's safe to say, at very, very least. Defend Our Health's recent research paper about the chemical hazards of plastic are really stunning. But I think Mother Earth would be pleased with your stated future that you desire in the paper to make things cleaner and safer. Could you say more about your research's recommendations for safer solutions going forward?
Of course, of course. I mentioned that we had spoken with Coca-Cola and some other companies about getting the antimony and cobalt out of their bottles. And that is an ongoing request that we hope that they will meet very soon. But there's a bigger picture here, and they need to stop using so many of these bottles. So we have an ask that Coca-Cola and other companies like them first get the most dangerous toxic chemicals out. But we also ask that by 2040, that they stop using virgin fossil fuel-based plastics. And we think it can be done. They didn't always use so many plastic bottles, but they're addicted to them. They can also move towards that in steps. And then there's legislation that I mentioned. So everyone can help support. When you see good legislation around plastics in your state or in your town, you can help support that. And we can all ask the EPA to strengthen their rules on ethylene oxide. And we can all be skeptical of company claims. Dig a little deeper, see what they're all about. And the best thing they can do is use a third-party certification. So one of the best of these out there is called Green Screen Certified. Green Screen is an avenue for finding safer chemicals that are used in common products. And they've conveniently grouped products into categories. So you can go on their website and see, for instance, like cutlery or cleaning products, and you can find who's got the safest stuff in it currently, who's got the worst. You can go product by product and find safer alternatives that way.
That's great. I'll link to Green Screen in the show notes.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I think if I were busy buying a lot of water or any other beverage in plastic bottles, I'd have this idea. Hey, maybe I could stop buying things in plastic bottles. Do you think that that might catch on?
It is quite hard to do. Yeah. Yeah. So it is hard to avoid. You know, we all do what you can, but I think it's a lot more important that the companies stop putting stuff in plastic.
Yeah. You're swimming upstream to make it happen. And that is brilliant. It's good strategy and it's good for all of us. Thank you for working on this project so assiduously.
Of course, I'm happy to chip away at these huge contaminants out there.
Yeah, everybody wins. So to close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your personal relationship with the earth, if you're game.
Sure.
When you were a kid, I wonder what your favorite thing was to do outside in nature.
Oh, I don't know that I could whittle it down to one, but one little thing I loved to do was race leaves and streams or maybe twigs. It's a little game my father and I played. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest and there was always a stream or creek nearby. And I don't mean to be overblown. Sometimes these were just like puddles that moved in a direction, perhaps, but we would race little leak boats.
Describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe.
Awe is a wonderful feeling. I live in the city these days, and I've spent a couple decades also living in more rural places. And I've kind of hopped back and forth, and I think it's important to find moments of awe wherever we are. So right now it's spring. It's kind of easy to me in spring because all the leaves are popping out and a lot of the trees have flowers and the tulips are coming up and birds are flying about. Sure, you can go to some very majestic looking, very remote place and catch some awe, but it's important to also just feel it every day. And I have dogs, so I walk them every day. And I try to always, you know, sometimes I'm distracted by them, but it's nice to be able to notice. Here where I live, we have a phenomenon. It didn't happen when I was a kid, interestingly, but there are a great deal of crows, thousands of them, who move across the city twice a day. And it coincides with sunrise and sunset. And they go to their gathering place or come back from it and spread out across to their little territories or whatever is going on. And that's an easy way to catch some moths when you see them all go by. And they pick each other up. So they come from further out. And then the ones where you are see the ones above and they say, oh, it's time to go. And they pick up, lift off and go.
What's one thing you're currently wondering about in nature? Perhaps crows. But is there some phenomenon that you see and wonder about or think about in your off time?
Oh, all the time. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about how everyone, all the critters out there and the immobile beings, how we're all going to weather climate crisis. We had a very extreme event a couple of years ago, and I got very worried about our trees. I wonder how will they cope. The conifers sometimes will lose needles and bring more on, but at what point do they cross a threshold and lose too many?
And finally, what is your favorite baby animal?
Oh boy, I don't know. There's a lot to choose from. I'll just go mainstream and say otters. Baby otters are quite fantastic. I haven't seen any in the wild, but I've been blessed to see some adult otters in the wild, and they're pretty fantastic.
They're adorable. Maya, you truly care about the health and well-being of the whole ecosystem, and you're skilled at holding powerful corporations to account. Thank you so much for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
Thank you for having me.